The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
News, science, the unexplained, space and the cosmos, exploring our past, our future, and the mysteries of our universe. Taking a critical look at reality and a journey to the edges of human understanding. The future is now. This is Micah Hanks.
From the high mountains of Appalachia in a bunker below ground, welcome one and all. It is the Micah Hanks Program. Glad as always to be here to be your host and to be getting behind the microphone, getting into gear and going in pursuit of the anomalous in our existence. As we do every single week right here, listen on demand via podcasting apps across space and time. And of course, our station affiliates there at the UnX Radio Network. Very glad to be joining you guys. Lots has been happening in recent days, in addition to a bit of travel that I've been undertaking, but getting back to the bunker and taking a look at things. Why are scientists now saying that the existence of the famous Loch Ness Monster, Nessie, might be plausible after all? Well, of course, I have thoughts about this, and you're about to hear them in short order. Also, veteran air traffic controllers have come out in recent days talking about the stranger side of things they see in the sky. And did you know the FAA has released some near-miss reports referencing UFO sightings by pilots and others? We'll look at all of that and a bit more. And then later in the program, I'm going to be very glad to welcome as our guest Beatrice Villarroel, who is a researcher and co-founder of the VASCO Network. This is a very important operation because it involves the search for possible non-terrestrial artifacts. In fact, I've talked about this a little in the past on this program. I did an article showcasing some of Beatrice's work, and she also, because of her research interests and efforts, has become associated with Avi Loeb's Galileo Project. But we're going to be focusing on her search for evidence of strange NTAs, non-terrestrial artifacts, that might have been in orbit around Earth before the dawn of the space age. That, and also a bit about lurker probes and much more. But first and foremost, I hope you guys are all doing extremely well. You know, in recent days, I was able to make a quick trip to California, get away for a little while, spend some time in the wonderful greater Los Angeles area. And it seems like I was just really beginning to get settled, just getting over the jet lag, before I ended up having to hightail it back to Appalachia, because in the days ahead, I've got a few things I've got to take care of here on the home front before I head up to Missouri. That's right, I'll be up there, as many of you guys have heard, the Midwest Conference on the Unexplained, there in Cape Girardeau, giving that keynote lecture on Saturday night. And of course, in the show notes, I'll have linked where you can sign up and get tickets to that event that Ryan Sprague, Joshua Cutching, Ken Gerhard, and a lot of other great speakers are all going to be at. Michael Huntington, also one of those speakers, who's joined us on the program in recent days. But again, this is going to be the conference this year that I recommend people actually attend if they want to hang out with me, have a drink, and chat about UFOs and all the other cool stuff we talk about on this program, which includes, from time to time, cryptozoology. Now, I have an entire sister podcast called Sasquatch Tracks, where we try to apply science toward that discussion. We have researchers come on the program. We also have scientists, when there are scientists willing to talk about that subject, that join us. I hope actually to have a sociologist in the days ahead from the UK who is currently conducting a scientific study about beliefs associated with Sasquatch and Sasquatch hunting, or Bigfooting, as some call it. Squatching might be another term that others use. You hear that a bit here in the sweet sunny South. But in any case, I'm interested in all the different aspects of attitudes toward belief in, research into, purported relictominoids. But although Sasquatch is kind of the poster child of what some call cryptozoology, there are actually anthropologists who loathe the idea of Sasquatch being lumped in with other cryptozoological claims. They say, no, this is a matter of anthropology, and we need to treat it as such. Well, for my own part, I guess I enjoy the cryptozoology too. And let's keep in mind that some of the earliest proponents, seriously, of the existence of creatures like Sasquatch, Ivan Sanderson, were also among the first to call themselves cryptozoologists. We often hear of Bernard Heuvelmans as being essentially called the father of cryptozoology, but it had actually been Ivan Sanderson that was the first to bring attention to that term and use it in print. That, I believe, in his book, Abominable Snowmen Legend Come to Life, still one of my favorite books on this subject, although I've gone back and I've looked at some of those early accounts that he used to bolster the case for the existence of creatures like the Yeti, and I find today that some of those accounts are a little less convincing than they might have seemed back in around 1961 when he wrote that book. But in any case, another one of those cryptozoological favorites of mine from back in the day had been the Loch Ness Monster. I was always fascinated with that subject, and in fact, one of the earliest books I remember having on that had been a little book written by Peter Costello called In Search of Lake Monsters. And as I understand it, that book actually was recently reprinted, and so if you go online, you should still be able to get copies of that, and I highly recommend it because it's a really fun read. But it's the first few chapters in that book that give what is, in my opinion, some of the best accounting for the Loch Ness mystery. Talking about some of the sightings that predated the modern era, where people had actually claimed to have seen this creature in the early morning hours, sometimes on land. And there were also the stories of the ship workers down there along the shores of the loch who said that they in the early morning often would see something out there playing around in the waters of the lake, and they began to call it the salamander. They didn't know what it was, but many of them said that they saw this thing, and there was maybe a hint in one of those early reports. One of the men who allegedly saw the beast they called the salamander said, "It was the biggest darn eel I'd ever seen." I mean, that was in Costello's book from way back in the early 1970s. And just a few years ago, of course, we saw environmental DNA studies, which seem to indicate that there is no evidence of any kind of unknown creatures in the loch right now, but there's an awful lot of eel DNA, and hence, perhaps, maybe eels are responsible for some of the sightings. But in recent days, I think we were all fairly surprised, considering the current scientific attitudes toward Nessie's existence, to see articles like this one from MSN.com saying Loch Ness Monster existence plausible, scientists say. How about that? As they note, researchers from the University of Bath and University of Portsmouth in the UK have found fossils of small plesiosaurs, an extinct long-necked reptile, in what used to be, no, not Loch Ness, no, an ancient river system now in Morocco's part of the Sahara Desert. As they note, however, 100 million years ago, it was the body of fresh water that was home to plesiosaurs, where these apparent fossils were found. So what does all this mean? Well, according to the article here at MSN.com, the finding shows that the marine reptiles, once thought to be sea creatures, may have dwelled in freshwater habitats. The fossils found consist of bones and teeth from adult plesiosaurs measuring 9 feet long and a bone from a baby measuring 5 feet. Now at this point, enter Nessie. As the article notes, the Loch Ness Monster, often nicknamed Nessie, is a mythical creature from Scottish folklore. The creature is said to live in Loch Ness in the Highlands. According to folklore, it's a long-necked creature that still dwells in the loch's depths. Now, I don't know. I mean, they can say it's a mythical creature from Scottish folklore, but that would have to be pretty recent folklore. Yeah, well, what about that story from the 1600s, Micah, about St. Columba? Well, sure. Many proponents of the existence of a beast in the loch have tried to say that St. Columba was one of the very first to have ever encountered the creature, or at very least, his account of encountering a water monster is one of the earliest written accounts of the so-called Loch Ness Monster. But in fact, that account actually emanated from a separate body of water much further upstream, so it's close enough, I guess, but not really a cigar when it comes to a description of a Loch Ness Monster. That's not really what's in that account. Well, but Micah, you were also talking about reports from prior to the modern era yourself, right, that Peter Costello and others have pointed out, some dating back to the 19th century. Well, sure, but I would also call these accounts that come from modern history. And yes, you can have modern folklore. That's very much a thing. In fact, I actually do think that primarily the Loch Ness Monster is an instance of modern folklore. But again, to use these kinds of terms, mythical creature from Scottish folklore, is a bit misleading because it gives us the impression that there are hundreds and hundreds of years of sightings of the Loch Ness Monster. Some maintain that there are, but really, the modern sighting wave that really gave rise to the legend didn't begin until around 1933 with Mr. and Mrs. George Spicer as they're driving along the brand new road that had been put in there next to the loch, and they claim not to see something in the loch, but some sort of a large lumbering beast moving across the road ahead of them in the direction of it. Yet again, a majority, maybe, of those early accounts actually involved seeing these things, whatever these monsters were alleged to be, on the shore, not in the water at all. Anyway, coming back to MSN here, they note plesiosaur fossils were first discovered in 1823. Their appearance, four long flippers, long necks, and small heads, are said to have inspired the tales of Nessie. Well, that's true, sort of, but a lot of the early accounts of Nessie make no mention whatsoever of a long neck. Yes, in the case of the Spicers, they were a good distance away from the object that they saw, whatever it was, and I don't doubt that they saw something. But they were a good distance away, and they probably didn't get a clear look. They said that it looked sort of elephant-like or walrus-like, and appeared to have a long neck that was undulating, right? Moving up and down. That apparently is something that a plesiosaur's neck, based on the structure of the bones in the neck, couldn't actually do. So whatever the Spicers saw, it doesn't sound much like a plesiosaur. What put that kind of Loch Ness monster equals plesiosaur motif in people's minds had been that famous surgeon's photograph, the one that was allegedly taken by a surgeon that showed this indisputably long-necked saurian-type creature out there in the loch. That photograph really is what cemented the idea of Nessie as a plesiosaur or perhaps an elasmosaur, as Dr. Dennis Tucker, formerly of the British Natural History Museum, believed the creature to be after having said he saw something like that himself in the loch. He said there was nothing else it could be. It must be an elasmosaurus. Now, I was really intrigued by Dr. Tucker's sighting because here was a very qualified scientist who all but lost his job for coming out publicly and saying that he saw an elasmosaurus. For those who don't know, that's also a long-necked, water-dwelling reptile that inhabited the Earth back in the day of the dinosaurs. Yeah, indeed, if Dr. Tucker said he saw one of these things in Loch Ness, I'm like, okay, maybe then there really was something interesting. But having tracked down his original account and how he described it, he never saw a long neck either, he just saw a big hump. Whatever it was that he saw convinced him there was something dinosaur-like in Loch Ness, but he didn't really describe a long-necked monster either, paradoxically enough. So now coming back again to MSN and the article here, they note that while the tales are often dismissed, according to these findings, you know, the ones recently from Morocco in the middle of the Sahara Desert, yeah, these findings actually make it plausible that such a creature would have inhabited freshwater lochs like Loch Ness. After all, plesiosaurs were found in an ancient lake that once was where the Sahara is today. We have our proof, don't we? At first, I was kind of wondering why all these outlets were running with the Loch Ness interpretation of this find. What does the discovery of fossils, even if they are in an ancient lake bed, but in the middle of the Sahara, what does that have to do with Loch Ness? As it turns out, there had actually been a press release that was released by the University of Bath that noted Loch Ness. And that makes a little more sense considering that the university in question is located in the UK, so they were naturally referring to something, a landmark a little closer by, and the long-held suppositions about the possibility that there could actually be something like a plesiosaur found in a landlocked lake like Loch Ness. But I was interested in this and why the press seemed to focus almost exclusively on that side of the story, and so I reached out to Dr. Nick Longrick there of the University of Bath, who also contributed to this study. And I asked him what he thought about the Loch Ness monster component here. And I will now quote from what Dr. Longrick wrote to me in an email. He said, I mean, the Loch Ness monster isn't likely. One aspect of the scenario, freshwater plesiosaurs, is plausible, he said. But Loch Ness is a tiny lake that couldn't support a population of animals the size of a plesiosaur. It's also very recent geologically. 10,000 years ago, it was under ice, a ravine beneath a glacier. Longrick went on to say that plesiosaurs couldn't survive there, and the last plesiosaur fossils occur 66 million years ago, so it's improbable that the lineage could have survived 66 million years without leaving any fossils. So there you have it from one of the researchers who was actually involved in this study that the media has just taken off with and begun to report as a story, as though these scientists have come out and said, you know, Nessie could exist after all. That's not really what they were saying. Now listen, again, the hopeful cryptozoologist in me would love for that to have been the case, but I guess the hard-nosed journalist in me sees otherwise. We need the facts, and the facts in this case, unfortunately, are that the media is just having some fun with you folks. That or they themselves maybe didn't read the report, but again, reaching out to one of the scientists in question, He was able to rather quickly clear up the matter for us. As you can read all about over at thedebrief.org, I'll have that story linked in the show notes for anybody who would like to follow up on this and get, as Paul Harvey used to say, the rest of the story. But now, before we go to break, I also should point out the rest of the story regarding something I've told you a lot about, and that, of course, is Athletic Greens. Look, you already know that I take Athletic Greens every single day. I don't just like it because it tastes great. No, it's actually a very optimized source of quality vitamins, minerals, and other things that are going to boost your gut health, give you more energy, help you sleep better at night, and overall, you're going to save money, too. Now, listen, I'm only 39, but I ain't a spring chicken anymore. You know, I don't have the energy levels that I used to have. Most of us don't. And that's okay. But, you know, one thing I've learned, if I do want to have the kind of strength and stamina that you would need if you wanted to outswim Nessie in a race down the middle of Loch Ness, is that you've got to watch your diet. You've got to watch what goes into your body if you're going to have the output that really is going to carry you through the day. So listen again, with Athletic Greens, every single packet that you add to a cup of water every morning is going to give you 75 high-quality vitamins, minerals, whole food-sourced superfoods, probiotics, and adaptogens. And frankly, I just don't start my day right any longer without it. And plus, again, when you start using Athletic Greens, your subscription comes with a year's supply of vitamin D, which is extremely helpful on those cloudy days and in the wintertime. And of course, you can know, rest assured in fact, that in supporting Athletic Greens, you are supporting a company that purchased carbon credits to support projects protecting old-growth rainforests in 2020, and of course that they donate to organizations helping to keep nutritious food on the plates in front of young children through charities like No Kid Hungry here in the United States. Now listen, guys, right now it's time to reclaim your health and arm your immune system with not only the great tasting but the convenient daily nutrition provided by Athletic Greens. To make it easy, Athletic Greens is going to give you a free one-year supply of immune-supporting vitamin D and five free travel packs with that first purchase. And all you have to do is visit athleticgreens.com/Micah. That's athleticgreens.com/MICAH. One more time, that's athleticgreens.com/Micah to take ownership over your health and pick up the ultimate daily nutritional insurance. And with that, it's about time that we get into some additional news here before we bring Beatrice Villarroel on the program to talk about the Vasco Network and the search for non-terrestrial artifacts, because there's been UAP news in the news. A lot of that these days, isn't there? What have veteran air traffic controllers said that they've seen? We'll tell you all about that here in a moment when we return on the Micah Hanks program. So what has been operating in our skies that air traffic controllers say that they've seen? Maybe the FAA has an idea, or maybe not. Welcome back. It is the Micah Hanks program. As always, we're bringing you the latest developments regarding UAP in the ongoing saga of our government's attempts to try and detect, analyze, and resolve questions about these mysteries of the skies. Now, apparently, according to our buddy John Greenwald over there at his website, theblackvault.com, a researcher named Kyle Warfel recently received a treasure trove, or at least a list of reports, that were mined from the FAA's database, this called the Comprehensive Electronic Data Analysis and Reporting, or CEDAR. And Mr. Warfel had apparently gone in search of reports that reference unidentified aerial phenomenon, or unidentified flying objects, from January 1st, 2008 to the present day. Now, I'm not sure exactly what it was about that date that caused him to begin the search. Maybe that was when this CEDAR system was instituted. I'd have to look into that. But in any case, these are fairly recent reports, and as I've noted in past reporting over at The Debrief, The FAA, as recently as 2021, had still communicated with me about this subject and used the old description for these objects, UFOs, or unidentified flying objects, and it's easy to see why. In fact, yeah, it's easy to see why, because they have used that term for decades, even though they have claimed for many years that they actually don't collect data about this phenomenon. Well, as it turns out, we have the following document that was released to Mr. Warfel. It was released in the form of an XLS document. I think there's also a PDF that John has made available there at his website, and I'll have that linked in the show notes. But let's take a look at some of these reports that the FAA has been collecting on UAP. The first one we have here reads as follows. FLG3768CRJ7/.QEWR/.ORD east of DKK advised R-38 controller of UFO sighting. According to the pilot, the object followed the aircraft until 1140Z QA and ROC advised. Now, one thing, of course, that is immediately evident is that there's a lot of FAA and, in fact, general aviation jargon that appears in these reports, but distilled down to their finest essence, we do get a gleaning of a few sightings that are a little bit more imaginative than the last one we just heard, such as the following. In this instance, the pilot of N993SA called to discuss his approach into UAO on the 11th of May 2012 between 1500L and 1600L. The pilot advised that his passengers saw an RC aircraft or UFO operating within 100 feet their landing at UAO. They also advised that the flight crew did not see the RC or UFO. They said that they were going to talk to passengers for more information. Then the pilot suggested an event that was just recorded in Denver about a UFO. I suggested he call TG at X7512 with any follow-up to this matter. We have the following as well. Airport Safety Dispatch called the tower with a report of a possible downed aircraft, glider, or kite 1/2 mile off the shoreline in the water. The area was broad between Airport Park and the Anchorage port. We reached out to a scout about 5 miles north to see if it could assist in locating this aircraft. Reports through dispatch continued for approximately 30 minutes while the scout continued to search. Finally, the report came in that the witnesses said it could have been a UFO. At this point, Safety Dispatch and Scout 9DM discontinued the search. Well, as you can see, most of these reports are actually fairly ambiguous. It's always big news, right, when somebody says they've gotten something released to them through FOIA about UAP. And yes, these are reports that mention UFO, like this one. ASQ-6064 initially reported a UFO sighting and crazy lights 50 miles northeast of MEM on a 015 heading, altitude unknown. AWE-1669, who was also in the vicinity, reported seeing mainly yellow lights near HOP Air Force Base. Now wait for it. This was later determined that HOP R-3702AB was active with live firing. In other words, it was most likely a planned military operation. As is always the case, I'll have these linked in the show notes if you guys would like to look over these. And it's not to say that there might not be a few hints at interesting cases, but the majority of them, as you can tell from the samples I've given, they aren't really all that interesting. And if anything, maybe the big takeaway here really has less to do with UFO sightings and merely the fact that the FAA certainly still receives reports of things that people can't identify. Very seldom are they described as large, structured objects that are undeniably anomalous in their appearance. But you know, there are some aviation professionals who say that they've seen things. Perhaps a better example worthy of attention right now is Colin Scoggins, a former air traffic controller who was also the subject of a lengthy article over there at the war zone in recent days. Scoggins was quoted in the article saying, as far as how most controllers feel if they are real, presumably talking about UAP, he says, I think most people think they are. And whether they believe they are not from our world, I'm sure there are a few. I would think most believe they are probably from our world, and probably our own government. The Warzone notes that Scoggins added that there was a small percentage of conspiracy theorists among the ATCs, just as there are in the general public, who will believe what they want to believe, although he doesn't recall ever being told not to report his findings, nor did he think that any controller felt as though their job was in jeopardy if they did. He did say, I had 3 instances I could think of. One of them was definitely a meteor smashing into the ocean. One pilot saw it and thought it was a UFO. Another guy that was flying a 90-degree angle from him saw it and said, no, it's definitely a meteor, and went right into the ocean. So we could write that one off. Another one was at dusk or dawn, he said. We had a Boeing 747 pilot swear that one of the passengers seated in the back said that they saw rockets fired at their plane. Now, these kinds of reports, by the way, always stand out to me because of that book I wrote a few years ago called The Ghost Rockets, where it did actually include a few accounts that were harvested from FAA databases, which showed that these objects do get reported from time to time. And people, pilots and passengers, by the way, do claim sometimes to see rockets, missiles, things like that. So as Scoggins says, back then we used to have an air traffic assistant for tracking systems, and they were usually ex-pilots. This guy was an ex-Boeing 747 right-seater, and he says, you know what my guess is? Was it in a turn? And I told him, yeah, and he goes, at dusk or dawn, the light can shoot out the window across the wing, and when they straighten the wing back up, the light comes back at you. In other words, they believed it was an optical illusion that caused an untrained eye to think a rocket was being fired at the plane. That pilot, Scoggins added, had been nearing warning area 102, which was sometimes used for live fire, but normally wasn't. We also didn't have any military activity going on in that area at the time, so it couldn't have been a rocket fired at them because, well, there wasn't anybody up there. As Scoggins is reported saying in the Warzone article, the only other one we did have, involving something unusual, he said, was a high-moving aircraft at 49,000 feet on a straight line passing over New York City doing about 900 knots. We brought it up to the military 3 or 4 times, and they just kept saying, nope, we don't see anything, and I think it was definitely a real radar target. So what in the world was that? Scoggins says, my guess is that the military knew who it was, and they weren't going to tell us. As the article notes, Scoggins is confident in this assertion because, before 9/11, he said that the military shared the same radars that Boston Center used on the coast. He explained that if he was using the radar located in Riverhead out of Long Island, so was the military. And if he was using Box Harbor radar up in Maine, the military was looking at the exact same thing that he was. Hence, he was pretty sure they knew it was up there, they just weren't talking about it. Anyhow, it makes for a really interesting read by Emma Helfrich, and you can find that over there at the Warzone. I'll have it linked, of course, in the show notes for ease of access. But right now, I'd like to shift gears and get right into things with our guest who's going to be joining us this week. I'm really excited to have her here on the program, and I want to thank Chrissy Newton for lining this up. Even though I was already familiar with Beatrice's work, we covered some of her research over at The Debrief, and talking with Chrissy recently, she said, hey, I know Beatrice. We've been in touch. In fact, I want to interview her. Why don't I book her on your show? So a very sincere thanks goes out to the Neutron herself, Chrissy Newton, for lining up our guest, Beatrice Villarroel, who's a postdoctoral researcher holding the position of Nordic Fellow with Stockholm University in Sweden. Among other positions she holds, she is also the principal investigator of the Vanishing and Appearing Sources During a Century of Observations project, otherwise known as the VASCO Network. She's also the co-author of a number of papers recently that have been looking at very novel propositions in terms of how we might scan the skies for evidence of what she and others have begun to call non-terrestrial artifacts. Is it really a crazy idea that extraterrestrials might have placed probes in orbit around planet Earth many decades, perhaps many centuries, or even thousands of years ago? After all, that's what we do, right? We send probes out into space, we put probes in orbit around nearby planets, and we try to study those planets and collect imagery. Maybe we have actually been the subject of extraterrestrial surveillance. What a concept. I'd like to get our guests' thoughts on this, so welcome to the program, Beatrice Villarroel.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
Well, the honor's all mine. And again, you know, when I read your paper, which we're going to discuss a bit later, I was just so intrigued by the novel approaches to studying the potential for anomalous objects in Earth orbit, and it's truly innovative what you do. First, I do want to mention, by the way, that recently there were celebrations held for the L'Oréal UNESCO for Women in Science in Paris, one of the most prestigious prizes in science given to female scientists. Prizes are awarded in 3 tiers, and I'm very happy to hear that you were awarded the National Award in Sweden for 2021, and then this year also a prize in the International Rising Talents category for early career scientists, so congratulations.
Thank you, thank you. I'm very happy for that. I'm super glad.
Yeah.
It's a extreme honor for me to have received it.
Well, again, it just shows that people are really paying attention to the work of scientists, up-and-coming scientists, like yourself. I couldn't be more thrilled, and I really appreciate you letting me know that you have been the recipients of awards like these. Beatrice, tell me about yourself. Let's go back to your background and how that led to the main focus of your scientific interests.
Actually, I have a very mixed background in the way that I was never sure about the exact path I wanted to take, contrary to many of my colleagues. I like as a child, I was very, very curious and I loved to do a lot of different things. I loved writing, I loved music, I loved reading. I was reading a real lot as a kid. And I was, of course, very curious about how the universe was working. And as I like was growing up in my teenage times, I particularly much loved molecular biotechnology and molecular biology and all these things related to this type of white biology science. And at the same time, I wasn't sure whether I wanted to become a professional musician or not. So I had this, I was torn between music and science, and eventually I chose science, and music became a hobby for me. So at university, I started with a civil engineering program in molecular biotechnology. And at the fourth year, I became far too fascinated by galaxies and how galaxies are forming. And well, today I'm an astronomer.
That's just
but it
fascinating.
Wasn't this clear path as many people are telling about that they wanted to be astronomers since they were children. Well, I actually loved the space since I was a kid, but being an astronomer wasn't a clear-cut choice because there were so many fascinating things.
Yeah, so astronomy came a little later. And by the way, I just have to say, like yourself, it was the same struggle, science or music. I love them both, but one becomes a profession, the other becomes, well, actually, I still do play music professionally. What instrument do you play?
Violin. Which one do you play?
Well, I play guitar, but I studied classical violin for about 6 years myself, and I bet I'm nowhere near as good as you are on that instrument. So guitar is my primary instrument.
Oh, but you play classical guitar as well, then?
I started as a classical guitarist, and now I'm more of a electric guitarist. I still play acoustic music as well quite a bit and do that professionally. But again, you know, I find that people who are scientifically inclined often are musicians. Do you see that to be the case as well?
I see that. Funnily enough, I see that more in the older generation than in the younger generation, and I don't know why. But among my close colleagues, they're also musicians.
Yeah.
So not all of them, but several of them are also musicians. So or maybe it is that I fit better with people who are also musicians and scientists. I don't know.
I do seem to recall there being a paper that was done a few years ago that said that especially people who are trained in music at an early age tend to be more open-minded, which I think is requisite for science and especially for the kind of work that you're doing. Let's go over to the May issue of Acta Astronautica. You and several colleagues published a paper that really caught my eye, no pun intended, because the title is A Glint in the Eye, Photographic Plate Archive Searches for Non-Terrestrial Artifacts, which elaborates on how potentially anomalous non-terrestrial objects might be located. To quote from that paper, it focuses on searches for multiple transients in old photographic plate material exposed before the launch of the first human satellite in 1957. Can you give us a quick breakdown of what this entails, what the process is, and what you and your colleagues aim to achieve in doing this?
Okay, so let me try to summarize it briefly. I will do it on the fly.
Sure.
So there's, let's say if we would like to look for a probe in modern data, ET probe. So ET has sent a probe somewhere in the solar system or around the Earth and placed it here. And now we want to find that. How would we look for it? Well, it's pretty difficult because we have so much of space trash in orbit around the Earth. We have so many satellites. They predict that there's something like 30 million of pieces of reflective metal in orbit around the Earth, like pieces that are larger than 1 centimeter or so in radius. So there's a lot of contamination that we humans have created at this point in order to look for an alien probe and easily detect it with our telescopes. So the idea we have here in this paper is actually a very simple one, and it surprises me that there's no earlier paper that proposes the same thing, because it's something so obvious it feels like. And that is, let's, instead of using the modern data, how about if we use the photographic plates that were exposed in the times before Sputnik 1, before humans contaminated the entire sky. And there's a lot of data sets out there, digitized. Many of them are digitized, some of them are not digitized, but where anyone, you, me, everyone who are interested can simply go to this data set and look at images. And there are specific signatures that you can look for that are typical of something that is highly reflective and not natural. For example, short-lived transients in one little image. And these kind of things one can look for, something that is, it's very easy to look for something that is artificial if you look at data from an uncontaminated sky before the space age.
Yeah, it's such a fascinating line of research that you're involved in. And, you know, to me, it seems very evident that over the years, many great discoveries resulted from scientists thinking about things, often simple things, that nobody else had thought of doing beforehand. I'm very glad Beatrice is involved in this research right now, and we're going to continue talking about it with her when we return right here on the Micah Hanks program. Welcome back. Continuing this conversation with researcher Beatrice Villarroel about the VASCO network and the search for non-terrestrial artifacts. Boy, this is so in my wheelhouse, I'm sure you can tell. We'll get back into that conversation here in a moment. First, I do want to remind you guys, if you aren't already ex-subscribers, it's easy to do and it's fun. You just got to head on over there to micahanks.com/podcast. You'll see X memberships in the upper right-hand corner of the page. Click that link. That'll get you where you got to be. And of course, we also have all those links included in the show notes. Definitely hoping to see a few of you guys up there at the Strange Tales 2022 Midwest Conference on the Unknown, which is going to be this August 5th through 7th. That's definitely sneaking up on us, but hopefully a few of you guys out there in the listening audience will be in attendance. And of course, last but not least, definitely follow my work over there at thedebrief.org, where you'll find regular reporting and including some reporting on the work of guests like ours this week, Beatrice Villarroel. Now, jumping back into things here, you know, Beatrice, there is that old expression that a picture tells 1,000 words. And I'm pretty sure we all know that's not necessarily true, but I think it is the case with some of the photographic plates that you and your team with the VASCO network are looking at, that you can actually discern an awful lot from some of these images. And I'm interested in seeing if you can kind of talk about the ways that we can spot anomalies in photographs like this and how the number of flashes or glints that might appear and the spacing between them can actually tell us a lot about the object that's being observed. Can we discuss that a bit?
So there's a lot of things one can learn from that. Assuming that one can repeat the observation or find like many examples and many high quality examples. One of the things that is like very easy to look for is if you would have certain glints that are lying along a line. That's something that you would naturally get if you have a satellite that spins and from time to time you get this reflection that causes this glint. A very fast reflection is, it will look like a short-lived transient in your image. And let's say nowadays, if you would have something like that happens, you would have a very short-lived transient of half a second. Maybe that would be recorded. But many of the surveys today use the CCDs, or most of the surveys use today like CCDs or CMOS technology, which means that you have much shorter exposure times. While in these photographic plates surveys, we had like long exposure times, like 1 hour or something like that. And during this time, you could see sometimes, let's say, see several glints. So there are like images from the 1980s where you have a satellite and you can see like several glints falling on a line. Now the question we ask, okay, so we know that a satellite that is like spinning fast is going to leave like a pearl band with many glints in an image. Now something that is going to spin much slower will leave just a few of them. So what we did was that we did some calculations to see how many links do you need to have in a line in order to separate the alignment from what can be caused by randomness? Because if you randomly would throw out some type of very star-looking defects on a plate, maybe in extremely rare cases, a few of them will align along a line, but in most cases, they are not going to have any alignment at all. So you can do this calculation in order to separate between, because some people were telling us, like when we wrote, we had another paper in 2021 where we saw nine star-looking objects appearing and vanishing within half an hour, which might be interpreted like something that is highly reflective and in orbit around the Earth. Alternatively, could be some type of plate defects or contamination. So how do you actually separate between the two cases, between this, like the boring case of that is some type of contamination or some type of, or that it is actually something real caused by, let's say, these highly reflective objects? And that was the main cause for the ACT Astronautica paper. And the idea there is that you can look for this, the same phenomenon, but require that you find the cases where they are aligned along a line. And then you need to do some statistics and estimate the number of these stars that you need to have along a line. And we find that if you have four transients, simultaneous transients that are star looking and they fall on a line, that is already a very good indicator of that this is the phenomenon we are looking for.
Yeah.
Albeit not a proof, but still it's going to reduce the probability for plate defects to be the cause of these weird occurrences of simultaneous transients.
Certainly. Yeah, indeed. Right now, again, this is virgin territory, but reducing the likelihood of you know, finding something that is less of interest in this study and using statistics to help bolster the case that we have something interesting that is somewhat repeatable, that is indicative of a highly reflective object, perhaps turning or tumbling as it's moving through space. I mean, this is just fascinating to me because, again, in that era prior to 1957, if there are objects that are discovered up there from that era, and we know we didn't put them up there, it's a really interesting, perhaps compelling possibility in terms of what else might have been in Earth orbit and where the origin point of that technology could be. Now, Beatrice, you've also expanded this search into a citizen science effort with what's known as the VASCO Network, which currently has a team of about 40 specialists from different academic backgrounds, amateur astronomers, and citizen scientists working on this search. Let's talk a little about the VASCO Network and this really cool citizen science effort that you are bringing into all of this as well.
So the VASCO Network, like you said, we are around 40 scientists from different disciplines, and we are from four continents, not Australia, not yet so far. And what is the goal of the VASCO Network? Like, original goal has been to search for vanishing objects. And our goal was to look through these old images in order to find a star that was there in the 1950s that has vanished today. So this was the original intention we created it with. And we have also a citizen science webpage that was developed by scientists at Uppsala University. And so the whole webpage has been designed so that you can easily look for things that were there in the 1950s, but are no longer there today. And as things have developed, we are probably going to upgrade it, the interface, the coming years, or the coming year, to be more precise, uh-huh, in order to more specifically look for these kind of transients related to potential ET probes.
Now, the transients aren't the only things that the VASCO Network is looking for. You also are searching for vanishing stars, am I correct?
Exactly. Uh-huh. Exactly. So that was the kind of the original idea we started with. It's just that in 2021, in 2020, we found this very weird case of nine simultaneous transients that we don't know yet if it's real or not, but where you see these nine star-looking objects appearing in an image and never seen again. Hmm. And after that, we started realizing that we might need to expand the searches and also try different research directions at the same time.
Yeah, and we'll come back around to that string of nine transients, which has seen a lot of coverage in recent days. We, of course, have talked about this a bit over at thedebrief.org in that recent article that we did about your research. I want to get into the discussion right now about non-terrestrial artifacts, or NTAs. There are a lot of possibilities in terms of the different kinds of things that an NTA might come to represent, maybe even some possibilities we haven't thought of. But generally speaking, what are the kinds of things that we would expect an NTA, if we were to find one, to be?
Well, let's say if another civilization at a neighboring star decides to send a probe to us, they might already know that Earth is a good planet for having life, so they might send a probe to, well, a probe around Earth. Mm-hmm. And now let's say that this probe might stay around Earth for maybe 200,000 years or so, and it might disintegrate over time, and the little metal pieces might still give off some kind of reflections. So that would be one type of NTA that we might be able to observe, and it wouldn't even have anything to do with the idea of UFOs or UAPs. It simply would be that some other civilization sent something and we would find the artificial remains.
Right.
That's one possibility.
You mentioned in your paper, by the way, active and passive NTAs. Could we just kind of break down the differences between what an active NTA would be versus a passive NTA?
Well, a passive could be like in this example that I said that one would have remains of a probe, mm-hmm. something that no longer is in use, but that aliens or some other civilization put around the Earth at some point. Active would be, let's say, a UFO or so.
And of course, we'll get more into the discussion of the UFOs and UAPs a bit later, because I do want your perspectives on that and, you know, some of the challenges that scientists who are willing to look at that subject are facing right now. But first, I also have to say, Beatrice, that I love that unique interface that you have made available online that provides tutorials for those who want to get involved in this research effort. From there on the VASCO page, the words citizen science is highlighted with a hyperlink, and you can click that and it will take people to this portal. Can you talk a bit about what VASCO provides online for this citizen science project that allows people to almost immediately get up to speed and get involved?
Well, we have a manual there, and also this web interface is gamified because we have two leading scientists there, Mikael Laksuvarju and Christian Pelkmans, who have been working very hard with trying to make the webpage appealing and, well, for a person who simply looks at the image and wants to have some fun when doing this. it has been gamified. And we hope to do even more gamification over time. So there's the manual. We also have a webpage in French and in English. A bit, one can only reach the French page if you go to the VASCO homepage first. So what one can do there is to look for vanishing objects, but you can also look for everything else. Let's say if you see that you find an image where Santa Claus is there with his reindeers. Well, it wouldn't be a vanishing star, but we would be very happy if someone pointed it out.
Yeah.
So the citizen scientists can make comments there.
Yeah.
Now we're hoping to upgrade it a little bit more in order to include all these new research directions that we are working with lately.
Well, certainly. And I have to say, again, the idea of gamifying this, in other words, making this something that is both fun, but where people can quickly become active participants, you know, I'll go ahead and say I think it's just brilliant. I mean, people who otherwise may not be so inclined to do this kind of research, you're making it so much more inviting, and thereby that, to me, helps to potentially ensure the success of outsourcing this in a citizen scientist effort. So, I mean, I think it's just brilliant, that approach. Now, Beatrice, I also want to ask you, what are the current results of this search? You'd mentioned that string of nine particular transients, which kind of got the ball rolling on this possibility that NTAs might be able to be observed, not just vanishing stars. So what are some examples of where the current research stands, anything that you've found, and potential anomalies that you and your colleagues might still be looking for?
So before we started the citizen science project, we did some of this research effort of looking for vanishing stars manually by hand. Let's say, for example, I remember when we published a 2020 paper, I had to look through 24,000 of objects myself. That was a heavy work. I will never repeat that. I lost one dioptry in eyesight, and I lost a lot of nerves probably on it. Anyway, so one thing that came out is that we found 100 of examples of objects that you could find in the images from the 1950s, but you could never see them again. So let's say we had 100 mysterious transients that we think are kind of unnatural transients, most likely, where you see something very briefly flared up in the 1950s in this image, and then it vanished. So that's one of the things we are still working with, trying to understand what they are. Now we have actually, in an effort led by Enrique Solano at the Spanish Virtual Observatory, we have identified 5,000 more of these examples, and we still don't know what they are. But I guess a very good guess is that it could be some type of flaring stars that were caught in the bright phase, or maybe some type of optical afterglows to a gamma ray burst. And so we have these lists of targets of something that flared up in the 1950s. Now, these targets have to be very well investigated, and like one can probably do a lot of fun astrophysics research with them. SETI scientists can take our lists of objects and also look for lasers if they're interested in that, because they would also like show up like some type of transient. And maybe it would recur after some time. So this is one thing that we got out of it, this kind of this list of what some people call vanishing objects or vanishing stars in the catalogs. Another thing that we talked about earlier was this simultaneous transients, where we saw these 9 objects appearing and vanishing. Now, a third thing that has come out is that we have been looking specifically for stars that appear in several epochs. Let's say they appear both in the 50s and in the 80s, and later they vanish. We have not been able to detect a single such so far, but we have only been searching for that with an automated method, while the citizen science effort still might give us a different result. So by the end of the year, we will know. Right now, we have like 280,000 of classifications that we have reached with the citizen science project. And the citizen science project, we have been working a lot with the scientists and amateur astronomy associations in Algeria and in Nigeria. So they have been helping us a lot, like searching for these vanishing stars and doing outreach efforts and workshops and so on, which has been really fantastic. And we really love these collaborations because it's super fun.
It is super fun.
So we need to analyze everything that came out of that, and we are in the work of doing that. And let's see if there will be any vanishing stars, or if the citizen science project will confirm the results of the automated version that said that maybe there are objects that, or even if we see some stuff that vanishes, maybe these are simply these short-lived transients, while if one really wants to find a real vanishing star that is there for hundreds of years and in many images and later vanishes, that might be extremely rare. And let's see if that result still is confirmed by the citizen science project, or if it will be contradicted.
Indeed. You know, I'm so excited about research efforts like this, and it's very evident that in this case, as in so many similar cases in science from over the decades and centuries, in fact, that sometimes what you end up finding is not the same thing as what you went in search of. You set out, you embark upon your quest, and you end up finding all kinds of new mysteries along the way. That certainly seems to be the case for Beatriz Villarroel and the VASCO Network. We'll continue this conversation as we look ahead at the future for such discoveries and those potentials when we return right here in a moment on the Micah Hanks program.
Thank you.
Welcome back. Rounding out this week's conversation with the very wonderful and very, very talented researcher Beatrice Villarroel. I'll have information about where you can learn about her research online and also read some of her papers. They're in the show notes. Really great work that she and so many others like Avi Loeb are engaged in right now. And, you know, with the recent launch of the James Webb Space Telescope, it really seems that this is going to be one of these periods in history where we have gone in search of the unknown, and boy, are we ever going to find it. That seems to have been the case for you, Beatrice, and, you know, a question that comes to mind, as far as the search for extraterrestrial intelligence and evidences of them, we have long searched out there with the assumption that we're going to find evidence of ET on distant planets. And therefore, we train our telescopes on distant worlds, and we attempt to try and learn what we can in that way, and we haven't really found very much. But I've often wondered if indeed we as humans are inclined to send probes into space, and even to put them, park them in orbit around planets and at Lagrange points, what if an extraterrestrial civilization did the same thing and they decided to monitor us? And so a natural question I have is, why, in your view, Beatrice, have there not been more researchers in the past who have looked closer to home as you and your colleagues have begun to do?
Well, I think it's a multidimensional problem, because first you have some type of societal stigma related to the idea of that the aliens have been here, a very strong societal stigma. But then also, we have actually sent probes to Mars, we have sent it to the moon, and we haven't seen anything. I mean, there have been a lot of invested effort into looking at the surfaces of, like, well, of Mars and so on, and one sees nothing. And then the question is, like, is it simply that scientists have the stigma, or is it also that we maybe haven't seen anything that has been convincing so far? And then there's the third problem, which is just a simple bias, that if you have a stigma, and people know that, no, this result cannot, or people think that this result cannot be real, when there appears some type of leads in that direction, they will overlook them. So I think it's these three components that have made it difficult to search too close to home.
Indeed. You know, you have written, Beatrice, that alien probes could be in plain sight, maybe even on the surface of the moon, on asteroids, Trojans, minor planets, or on Mars. I've spoken in the past with certain researchers who have also followed this line of work, including Jacob Hock-Misra, who has some great ideas about this. You've also written that such objects might reveal themselves through emissions in the radio or microwave or visible light. So there are a lot of ways that maybe we could be searching for nearby NTAs, not entirely exclusive to the optical realm. We might be able to find radio emissions and things. Could you speak to that point a bit?
So my idea is that one should always start with the cheapest type of explorations one can do. Let's say the VASCO project uses public data. All these images already exist. So what actually, like, what takes time is, really the effort we put into analyzing these data. But we don't design any missions. We haven't designed any satellite that went there to search for something. And my feeling is that we need to do more of cheap searches for these type of probes before we embark on something extremely expensive or a very expensive mission. Because once one embarks on a very expensive mission in the billion-dollar class, you get one shot. And when it fails, then people are not very excited about keeping to fund a particular research.
Great point.
And with a colleague of mine, we are now working on a proposal that I cannot say anything about in public, but where we have designed a rather inexpensive program that could reveal these kind of probes. So I hope over next year to be able to tell more about it. Let's see how that goes.
Well, it sounds like next year, you're going to have to come back on the program and tell us about this next year.
Well, we need to apply for funding first.
Sure.
We have lots of ideas on how to do that. So
indeed, that is so exciting, though, and I can't wait to hear more about that in the future. Of course, once funding has been gathered and the actual research effort is more underway, I am also particularly interested in those probes that might be a little harder to find, that may not be so obvious. These, I guess, have collectively been referred to as lurker probes. My simple question for you would be, if indeed there are probes that are somewhat stealth and aren't easily found, you know, they aren't in obvious places like out there at Lagrange Point 2, where we've put the James Webb Space Telescope, might that account for why we haven't found these yet?
Absolutely. I think it's about that one needs to design smarter ways of looking for them. And there are many excellent methods in order to look for these LIRC probes that have never been tried out. And I think that is one of the first steps one has to do to look for these LIRC probes.
When you talk about smarter methods of looking, I mean, naturally, something that just kind of springs to mind for me involves machine learning and artificial intelligence. How do you think that AI and machine learning can be applied toward the search for evidence of ET technologies and NTAs?
Well, I'm sure that this can be applied, but I think what is more efficient is always going to be the human eye.
Yeah.
This has been my experience in the last years, is that even if you can try to do things like automate stuff, usually if you find an anomaly, if you want to look for something really anomalous, it's easier to have a human rather than having a machine, because you don't know in advance what is the anomaly. So I'm not super, super convinced by that AI will help us to find the lurkers. I more think that it will be clever experiments by individual scientists, and what we have to do is to get more funding for this type of SETI science, because it's super difficult to get funding for it, and have more brains in this, and more people who get individual research funding rather than one single mission, and then we might be able to find those lurkers. And I think that will work better than any machine learning.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think at least at the current stage of where machine learning is, it may be a very powerful tool that will help us sift through initial data. But at the end of the day, I think that there is a lot more efficiency, a lot more capability with the human eye, at least for now. And I think that most people who've been involved in similar searches would probably agree. But now, taking the AI question in a slightly different direction, I'm really curious to get your thoughts about a very unique prospect. Some would say that in the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, that we're more likely to actually encounter artificial intelligence created by ET rather than biological organisms. What are your thoughts on the possibility that various technologies we might be searching could actually represent an extraterrestrial form of AI in itself? I know this is a pretty far-out idea, maybe even more in the realm of science fiction than science fact for now, but the possibility exists. I'd like your thoughts on that.
Well, the first thing I'm thinking about is that I would find it as a very boring result if the first civilization we encounter would be some type of AIs. I belong to the minority of people who think that the AI will never be able to match in creativity the humans. So it would be a very boring result. But it might also be a more likely thing, because how do you make something survive a long space travel? A very, very long space travel of maybe 90,000 years. Maybe you need generations of AI to construct and reconstruct themselves during the trip. It is possible. It is a very valid hypothesis, but I don't like it, if you say it like that.
Indeed, AI produced by aliens is a little less exciting than the discovery of actual alien life. But now moving over on to another topic that is somewhat tangentially related to all of this, there's a lot of discussion in recent days about unidentified aerial phenomena. And a few scientists like yourself, our mutual colleague Avi Loeb with the Galileo Project, and others do appear to be receptive to that discussion. I'd like your thoughts about unidentified aerial phenomena. In other words, the potential that some of these non-terrestrial objects or technologies might actually be right here within our own atmosphere, operating in the airspace around Earth, traversing our airspace, and maybe entering and exiting our oceans. What are your thoughts on UAP and the current dialogue that's focused so much on that?
Okay, so I will first explain my position. I'm a UFO agnostic, if we say it like that. I don't know what to think about the whole discussion. I find it interesting to follow. I don't like that it's being dismissed by some scientists directly. Like, I think it's a wrong attitude. We need to be open-minded, and we need to take some of this like report seriously in the way that we try to investigate what is it behind and what is the phenomenon that causes so many incidents to be recorded by the, let's say, the Pentagon. We cannot just ignore everything all the time and put it under the rug. We have to accept that there is something that is worrying people. And what is that? Can it be something that is natural and misunderstood? Yes. And then we have to maybe investigate it. I think it is time to remove the stigma. And it's also partially why I engage in these conversations. I think it's time to get rid of the stigma around UFO research, because I think it does far too much damage to the society, to science overall. And our science needs to be more free from stigmas and free from all this peer pressure to move it in one or the other direction.
Beatrice, I've really enjoyed this conversation. I do want to ask you before we wrap up, what is next for you? What are you working on currently? And what are the next steps for your current research efforts?
Well, my next step will be something far more boring, and that is that I need to secure funding because I'm out of funding. In December, it's all off. So I will be applying for grants, and it's going to be a very big challenge because, as I mentioned earlier, SETI isn't funded in Europe, and I would like to stay here. So that's going to be my first challenge. And the second thing is that I work together with a colleague on developing a program for looking for probes. So that will be very fun. And I hope we will have some luck in those applications.
Indeed. There are, of course, the traditional funding mechanisms, you know, applying for grants and what have you. But if it were ever to come on the table that independent funding were a option or a possibility, private investments could be useful. Is there any way that people who might be interested in following up with you and your research can reach out to you, get in touch, or follow your research efforts online if they're just interested in learning more about what you do?
Absolutely. I could give my email or my phone number if people are interested in helping us. And we will hopefully also launch a GoFundMe page soon. I'm still waiting for an okay from my university.
Ah, okay. So,
because there's a lot of tricky rules in Sweden when it comes to crowdfunding.
I see, yeah.
So we're going to try everything possible.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. And I guess that contact information is probably on the VASCO site. Is that correct?
Yes, otherwise I can provide it to you.
Excellent. Yeah, and I'll have that linked in the show notes so that folks who are listening to this podcast can just go into the show notes and you'll find Beatrice's contact information. You can find her websites. I'll link to all of that. And of course, the science paper as well. That way they can reach out if they're interested in helping out. And I do hope that if you launch the GoFundMe and you get approval for that, we can promote that here on the program for you as well, because I think it's very important work that you're doing. So Beatrice, I just want to thank you again for your time and really had a wonderful conversation. Let's make sure it's not the last one, okay?
Absolutely. It was really nice to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
It is indeed my pleasure. Thanks again to Beatrice Villarroel. And also, I want to thank Chrissy Newton, who in recent days over there on her podcast on the official Debrief YouTube channel also interviewed Beatrice in the latest installment of her podcast, Rebelliously Curious, two of the most talented gals that I know, sitting down and having a conversation about subjects near and dear to my heart, outer space and anomalies, so definitely not to be missed. And of course, you can follow the entire team's work over there at thedebrief.org. You can keep tabs on me at micahhanks.com. And of course, you can follow me on Twitter at micahhanks. I do occasionally tweet, although usually I've got my eye on other things of the anomalous variety, as you hear every week here on this program. Thanks for being along for the ride, guys. As always, it is my pleasure. I am your humble host, Micah Hanks. It is the Micah Hanks program, and until next time, you guys stay strange out there.